From the producer of Aliens and Terminator 2, L.A. in 1948.
How is it?
Bad.
It's always bad.
Something's coming, something ugly.
Everyone wanted power.
I'll be in my hands by Thursday. I'm attending a conference, and this volume is the key to my presentation.
A conference that starts at midnight?
Everyone wanted control.
It's in the book, over here. Promise, power,
price.
What price?
You're gonna be dead, Lovecraft.
I'm going to be on top of the world.
That should settle things once and for all about who was smart and who was a chump.
And everyone used magic. Black magic.
The Necronomicon. Must be some book.
Except Detective Lovecraft.
Damn it, Phil, everybody's got a compromise.
That's what I keep hearing.
Then what makes you so special?
He's the right guy.
I'm serious.
Then why are you wearing that hat?
But it's the wrong time.
Someone's throwing lesser demons at you, and you don't even carry a rabbit's foot.
I can handle it.
Well, I'm not worried about you, Phil. I'm worried about the people who might get in the way.
He's got 48 hours to save the world. Or what's left of it.
Phil, nothing in life's as funny as you think.
Fred Ward.
My collar may be a little frayed. Maybe I need a shoe shine. Nobody's got a mortgage on my soul. I own it. Free and clear.
Cast a Deadly Spell. The HBO original movie.
This spoiler-filled podcast is recorded live, unscripted, and intended for those over 18. Now prepare your ears for the audio stimulation they've been waiting for all day as we step into
the spoiler room.
I got my scotch. I will in a moment here. Hold on.
You've got your scotch. I've got your not your father's root beer. Dawn?
And if I have another glass of wine, I'm going to be asleep within 10 minutes.
Ah, okay. So Dawn already had her glass of wine. We have our beverages, and we are here on another edition of the Spoiler Room. And tonight, I've got a few crew members who are going to sit and talk with us on a very unusual film that is really big around our ring of friends, but I'm surprised it doesn't get talked about more, starring Fred Ward. It's an HBO film, and it's Cast a Deadly Spell. Now, what do you want to give the summary, or should I just read it off IMDb?
Knock Glenn? Yourself out.
I'll read it off of IMDb.
Read it off IMDb. I'm gonna be too snarky.
So in 1948 Los Angeles, everyone uses magic. Everyone except our hard-boiled private detective H. Philip Lovecraft. Yes, think about it just for a second. Who refuses for personal reasons? Lovecraft is hired by a mysterious rich man to recover a stolen book, the Necronomicon. Investigating, he finds that the book holds the key to taking over the world by magical means, releasing the Old Ones. Yes, Fred Ward does play Detective Harry Philip Lovecraft, but you also have a rather impressive cast, which I totally forgot about until I watched this again, because it's been years since I visited this film. And Dawn, we talked about this. What did you think of the cast in this film?
I was very surprised. I noticed right away David Werner, who has played in several Necronomicon for sure, other Lovecraft-based stories. I loved Clancy Brown in this, and Julianne Moore. I remember looking at her on the screen with Mark and saying, "Oh, look at that! This is pre-Photoshop. That's awesome."
Yeah, the Amazon Prime, which has it for free, folks, so you can check it out there, has a higher, better resolution rip of this film versus the VHS. And also in the room here with us is Glenn. Glenn, what'd you think about this cast, especially the role Clancy Brown had, something we don't normally see him in?
I like Clancy Brown. I like him in pretty much everything he does. I like the cast generally. Fred Ward, I have a love-hate relationship with. Okay. I enjoy Fred Ward, mm-hmm. but he's not really a good actor. So
I think with him, it depends on the role, though. This one I thought he did decent in, though.
He did okay.
He has a very, very unique style, and as long as you go into it expecting that style, you'll be happy.
Yeah. But I like Clancy Brown. I mean, David Warner, I always like, and he tends to be a bit typecast in a lot of stuff, but it works. It plays to his strength. And I also liked Raymond O'Connor as Tugwell.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. Yes.
He was that good mix. And you hate to say about someone, but he pulls off creepy guy really well when he wants to. I mean, in general, his if you just see a picture of him, he just looks like a normal guy. But man, when he wants to, he can really pull off the just creepy, like, dude, stop staring at me.
Well, I just loved the fact too with his character that he's this short guy, and he's the sidekick to Clancy Brown's character, Harry Borden, who for most of the film is considered the villain, and that guy's short, and he's got the really tall zombie with him who just makes him look even shorter.
Yeah.
But yet, you're right, he's a really creepy, scary guy. He was very entertaining in here. I enjoyed Clancy Brown. I forgot he was in here when I saw him. I'm like, holy crap, he's in a role where he's playing a major character.
The zombie?
Yeah.
He hasn't done much, but I remember he played a pastor or something on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Oh yeah. Okay, that's where
I mean, he did stuff earlier, I should say. I shouldn't say he didn't do much. He didn't do much after this.
Right. That is,
he was actually a semi-regular on, he was on some other shows in the past. I know he was on the I'm looking now at his IMDb. It's on the Jeffersons and some other stuff back in the day, but yeah.
The actor was Jamie Cardrich.
Was that him?
Yeah.
Or am I? Oh, I'm looking at the wrong guy then. Which one was the...
Jamie Cardrich was the zombie.
That was the big zombie. Oh, yeah, that was. I'm looking at the wrong guy.
Unfortunately, he passed away in 2000. But, yeah, he was in a number of things. He was in Fresh Prince. He was on Wayne's Brothers Show, Hanging with Mr. Cooper. He had been in a lot, including The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr., which is a whole discussion there. But it was funny seeing this very tall individual next to Tugwell. And Tugwell was an interesting character. But all of these characters, I think, were. I mean, the world building they did for this film, I think, was pretty impressive, don't you think, Glenn? What did you think about the world that they built with this magic everywhere in L.A.?
I liked it. I'm generally a fan of what would now be called urban fantasy, mm-hmm. and I like Lovecraft stuff, so it's a good mix. I mean, a little bit of it is. So this was back when HBO was not really that well known for making original material. And this definitely has kind of that 80s direct to VHS feel, where they do some things pretty well. Like, I think Clancy Brown plays his role and stuff like that. But at times it seems like the people who made this had never seen a film noir. And someone just verbally explained what film noir was, and they went and made the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Based off that description alone, because at times it's like they try to have that kind of noir feel, but then they just don't quite get there.
Well, yeah, in some scenes they do get there. You're right. It's kind of up and down. This was written by Joseph Dodery, who wrote and is still writing a lot of TV and not quite so much film. He produced as well as wrote, but so I can understand, it does have the made-for-TV feel to it. In fact, this was his second feature that he wrote right before he wrote Attack of the 50-Foot Woman.
Yeah. Well, he also wrote Witch Hunt.
Right.
Which I think is not to get off this movie, but is just a gets that feel across much, much better.
Mm-hmm. And well, you know, he could be have cut in his teeth too and kind of learned from this one, but I did like a lot of elements in Cast a Deadly Spell. It does still it does have the spirit of noir. You're right. It's not like a complete true noir, but it hits some of the tropes that you want and some of the beats in here. And Dawn and I were talking about when we were watching it, because she came over to watch it here. And one of the things with the world building I liked, and I think it's something that is missed nowadays in not all, but some films that are fantasy type stuff, is that there's a lot of stuff going on in the background that is pretty creative, and some of it's subtle as far as the magic goes. Dawn, remember we were talking about that, how some of the things going on in the background with this world building was subtle, whereas like today that would be like up front and in your face.
Exactly. I was thinking about that, you know, it's there and it's in the background, but like, and this is probably a bad example, but like in the Men in Black movies, when they show that there's the aliens among you, they make a point of zooming in and showcasing the things in the background rather than letting them just be in the background subtle.
Sure.
If you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, I know exactly what you mean. That's what I'm...
So the little things are there, and when you notice them, you're like, holy crap, did that really just happen? But they're not right in your face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they aren't. What about you, Glenn? Did you think some of the magic stuff for their world building that they did in here was creatively subtle?
I mean,
not all of it. I know some of it was kind of cheesy and in your face, but there's some stuff in the background.
Some was cheesy in your face, but I also like some of the things that they did. I mean, one of the first magical effects you see, I think, is brilliantly done, and that's when Tugwell kills the dude in the bathroom.
Oh, yeah.
With, you know, basically the 10,000 paper cuts. I mean, I thought that was really well done, and it wasn't your typical, oh, this is what, you're going to use magic and you're just going to... A lot of times when you see magic, they go for the super grand gestures of the, you know, I'm going to shoot fire out of my hands, or I'm going to throw someone completely across, you know, a city block. And this was just, I'm going to kill you with a bunch of paper.
Yeah.
So I liked it. I also liked the whole the scene in the diner with the where the demon ends up coming up out of the.
Oh, when the demon comes out of the soup and
because he had it was that little hex written on a note.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tugwell wrote the runes on a note and then just gave the note to HP, and he's like, oh, crap.
Yeah, and I some of that stuff was actually really well done, because it wasn't this, not everything was this, you know, these massive grand gestures.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where a lot of times magic can be more subtle. I mean, yeah, it ends up not being subtle when the demon pops up out of the soup and basically, you know, fillets the guy, but but it starts off small and then grows.
Well, and there's other things, too. The one that I pointed out to Dawn that I think is really great, and it's just a subtle thing, but it made sense, and it really fit and helped sell this world, was in the bartender scene, H.P. Lovecraft goes into the casino that's run by Clancy Brown's character, and he's talking
to... The Dunwich Room.
The Dunwich Room, thank you. He goes into the Dunwich Room, and he's talking to the bartender, and there's another bartender in the background cleaning shot glasses. But if you watch him, he's continuously pulling shot glasses out of thin air. He moves with his hand, and he brings a shot glass, cleans it. And I just, for some reason, I really loved that bit.
I completely missed that.
Yeah.
Wow. And I've seen this. I haven't seen it a lot, but I've probably seen it 3 or 4 times before I rewatched it just earlier this week.
Mm-hmm.
I never caught that one. Yeah, it's probably the most subtle thing, but he's sitting there cleaning this shot glass while Fred Ward's talking, you know, in the front of the camera, but just in the background you see him, but he kind of does a flip of the wrist and he's cleaning the shot glass, and then as the guy goes to talk on the phone, he puts it down and then flips his wrist and he's holding another shot glass and he cleans it and he flips it. And I'm like, wow, that's really subtle, and I swear that might have been a real magician they might have had there because of the type of effect it was. It was like Man, but there's a lot of practical. I mean, it's almost all practical effects.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's 1991. Mm-hmm.
Sure. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I like the effects and the makeup effects they had here, though we'll get to it in a little bit. Don had a little bit of an issue with the ending, but
that's just me.
But the creature effects I thought in here looked really well done. What did you think of them, Glenn? As far as the prosthetics and that, like with the werewolf they're interrogating in that.
I mean it's. I mean, yeah, it had a $6 million budget, but I mean, still, it's. For the amount of effects and makeup work they do, that's, yes, it was cheesy and corny, but it's okay. And it's, you know, and again, it's 1991. I like the Gremlins were really, really puppet-like. Like, really, really, really puppet-like. But I still enjoyed them. I liked the whole thing with the guy chasing around with the shotgun and stuff. But yeah, I mean, I think it's okay for, you know, I think people like us can appreciate it. I think someone new going in, like, you know, a 20 or 30 something, you know, who didn't grow up with this stuff, who's only really known, you know, CG,
sure,
is going to laugh it off. Mm-hmm. unless they're already really, you know, liking just this type of stuff, but it's definitely dated.
Some of it is dated, but you know, it's also set in 1948. So I think some of the cheese factor can be a little alleviated because it's in 1948, sure. You know, versus modern times. So I think mentally we put it in that context, and I think it allows it a little bit of freedom to where they can offer the little cheesiness a little bit less because everything looks a little bit older, so you're like a little more accepting of it. But what I liked with this world that they built was the fact that things were being used as magic, or like we mentioned, the Gremlins thing made sense, didn't it, John? I mean, they did work at trying to make this feel like a natural progression of society using magic.
Yeah, they did. They definitely had that feel of, well, it's just normal. Of course it would be gremlins that are screwing up my car. Of course it's the virgin that is the unicorn hunter. Well, what else would it be?
and that's what I liked is I liked the fact of that, and everybody knew about it. It's not like, oh, certain people knew magic, or with everybody knowing magic, they're just talking about this stuff in normal conversation. I mean, when we get to see the young daughter of David Warner's character, Amos Hacksaw, his daughter, Olivia Hacksaw, excuse me, not Hacksaw, Hacksaw. I mean, she's chasing a unicorn, and our detective just goes right away, oh, yeah, that's she has to be the virgin because, yeah, well, she was hunting the unicorn.
Yep.
But it's like common knowledge stuff, and that's what I really enjoyed as well is, like, you know, it wasn't like secret society type stuff at all. It's right out in the open, which you don't always see with especially things dealing with magic.
And yeah. And two, there was also the little spin on Lovecraft kind of getting razzed by everybody because, come on, you're still not using magic. Everybody's doing it. What's wrong with you? Everybody's doing it. Come on.
And he never gives the reason either of why he doesn't choose to use magic. And I liked that, you know. I mean, in all honesty, I hate to be the get-off-your-lawn type of guy, but there's just some elements they leave out there and don't fully explain, and I feel like if this was like remade, they would spend chunks of the film just explaining everything.
I think the closest they came to an explanation is when Lovecraft and Connie Stone are in his office, and he's talking about he wants to do it. He wants to keep his integrity. He doesn't want to be a sellout, but they don't explain why he would be a sellout if he would use magic. Yeah.
Well, yeah, he does allude to it because he says, "Well, my soul is my own."
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes you wonder, oh, did everybody sell their soul in order to use magic, or are they selling their soul to use magic? yeah, you're right. It is hinted at there, but that's about the most that we get out of here.
Yep.
You know, and I always chuckle when the Necronomicon comes up because being the horror fan that I am, it always harkens back to Evil Dead, and I just get a kick that the Necronomicon is the center, once again, of a story. Now, out of the three people here, I am H.P. Lovecraft dumb. I will say that right now. These two fine folks who joined me know a lot more about H.P. Lovecraft. So I will ask, does the Necronomicon feature in his stories often, or not at all, or was this just added?
All the time.
All the time. Okay.
It is a Lovecraft creation.
Ah, okay. That's what I was wondering about, because you know, you see it referenced and see it throughout horror films especially, and yeah, that's just what I was wondering about. That is okay. Well, that answers that question then. So the Necronomicon, they're chasing the Necronomicon around, and what'd you think, Glenn, of the PI story itself? If you look at it from a PI story more so than the magic story, how'd you feel about it? Was it weak? Did it feel like it was kind of that hard-boiled type of pulp story? Mystery and the double crosses and such?
Now I have to think, because the fact that I've seen this multiple times, you know, later watches, obviously that's all spoiled for me. Sure. But, I mean, I think going into a noir, you pretty much assume that everyone is going to screw everyone else over. that's generally just an assumption. I mean, the only person who's not is the detective.
Right.
He might play someone a little bit, like, or not really play someone, but play dumber than he actually is. But you kind of expect, I mean, anyone who is in the least bit a villain is going to screw someone over. There is about, I would say, a 60-40 chance that a former lover of a detective in a film noir is going to screw him over.
Mm-hmm.
It's not guaranteed, but the odds are more likely it'll happen. And it's less along the lines of she's just evil, as more that it's that this is, you know, there's that thing in film noir where it's people are looking out for themselves. Mm-hmm. They got to take care of themselves. So I think they get that pretty good. Yeah, because, I mean, it does hit those notes. I mean, you've obviously got Harry Borden.
Yep.
You know he's a bad guy.
Yeah.
He's a club owner. Of course he's a bad guy. That's obvious. Yeah. You know that he's out for no good. David Warner, of course, he's looking for an ancient magical book. His own daughter doesn't trust him, and she's out killing unicorns. Well, of course he's not a good guy either. And yeah, Connie's looking out for herself. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only one that's not is the statutory rape detective Grimaldi, who, you know, in today's current climate, that would never fly in a movie.
Oh no, that
would be like, I mean, it's. I remember the first time I saw this. I was freshman in college. I mean, boom! It's like, well, of course the dude's gonna sleep with her. That's someone's going to sleep with her, and it's not going to be Harry Lovecraft, because he's, you know, too much of the good guy. So someone's going to sleep with her to ruin all these plans. That's what's going to happen. It's got to happen. So of course, you know, as soon as Grimaldi's all like, well, gosh, you know, do 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 do. It's like, yeah, there we go. There's a guy who's going to, and then to top it off, the fucker's married too.
Yeah,
it's like when you skip the whole part where she's supposed to babysit your kids. And then you sleep with her. You skip that middle part there, apparently. So, but yeah, I mean that, and that's yeah. also something that dates the movie a bit, because yeah, that would, if she was 18, it'd be fine. I mean, sure. Yeah, she'd still be young, and it'd still be like, well, that's not right, but it wouldn't be quite the that's actually a felony.
Yeah.
Well, let's not forget she's played by Alexandra Powers, and while the character is 16, she's actually like 24.
Oh yeah.
I mean, she's not 16. There's no about her whatsoever. They could have easily made her 18 and avoided any possible potential controversy.
Well, and I don't think it was controversy so much in the 90s, because, I mean, figure the 90s was also the mid-80s through the early 90s was the whole, oh, my God, you can't possibly be a virgin. You're like 11 already.
Yes.
That was the movies that came out then, where it was just everything was the, how are you a virgin? You're almost 14.
Yeah.
There was a lot of peer pressure.
A lot of peer pressure movies
everywhere.
So, which is, you know, gone away because it's, which is pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's bad enough. Well, and that might also explain why, you know, despite what some people say that, you know, hey, look at that. Teen pregnancy is actually lower than it was in the 90s. I wonder why.
Yeah, the film definitely comes from a different age, even though it's about even an older age. But, you know, with the Grimaldi character, Dawn, I got the impression, I thought for a little while that Harry actually sent Grimaldi because he figured Grimaldi would sleep with the virgin, but it seemed like a surprise to him. Did it kind of lead you to that, to maybe think that maybe he was playing the back card or the hidden card?
I don't think so. I mean, because Lovecraft would have known that he was married.
Yeah.
And again, being the straight up good guy, mm-hmm. he wouldn't have thought that.
Yeah, that's true. He is more of a straight up good guy.
What about my actual thought is that he had Grimaldi with the girl because he figured the girl would be safe with Grimaldi.
Oh, yeah. You're right, because Grimaldi's married and he's a good cop.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't necessarily like good as in he does his job well, but I mean, he's a good guy who's a cop.
Yeah, but.
And he would have protected her.
Yes.
Well, she was very forward with certain things, though. I mean,
yeah, she was.
Don, what'd you think of the? Because we basically have three female characters in here. What'd you think of the female characters in here? Were they noirish for you? Did they seem a little too over the top? Did you have a favorite performance from one of them?
I'm gonna mispronounce her name. I think Hippolyte.
Yes.
The voodoo queen across the hall, the dance studio lady, loved her. I loved everything about her. I did not see her. That character I would not have seen in a noir movie. The other two were perfect. You had the femme fatale and you had the sweet, innocent little girl who needed the damsel in distress.
Right.
Those two fit perfectly for the tropes, fit very nicely within the noir framework. That Hippolyte, she was wonderful. Oh my gosh. The actress was spot on for her. I loved how she just kind of burst in on him, keeping him honest.
She was a great character. I actually wanted to see more of her. Hippolyte Kropotkin was the name, played by Arnisha Walker. Fantastic character. I wanted to see more of her. I really did. Because I thought, she was a great, fun character, and she's kind of, you know, has our PI's back, even though he owes her back rent all the time.
In a way, that's kind of a trope from a lot of movies, where you have that whole, you know, landlord who's always like, "Where's my rent money?" But they got a soft spot for the character. Mm-hmm. That's definitely a trope in a lot of movies, especially back then.
I suppose,
Back then, I mean, like in film noir-ish in 1940, you have that whole thing with so many detectives where they're back on their rent, or you know, or there's that character that's the landlord that's, you know, the "Hey, pay me," but you know, it's okay.
I suppose, yeah. I wasn't looking at her as that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and they took her that step further and said, "Hey, voodoo's magic."
Yes, they did.
And the only thing with her is occasionally her accent slips.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
but I love
it. It fit with the rest of the crowd.
But I love the character.
Yes.
She was great. And in fact, looking at this film, did it feel at all, like, they were setting it up almost as a series. This could have easily possibly been a series.
I think that was the intention.
Mm-hmm. That would make sense.
And they ended up doing a second movie that is set in the exact same universe with the exact same character.
Right, Witch Hunt, which took place in the 50s, I believe.
1950. Like
10, yeah.
Except they replaced Fred Ward with Dennis Hopper.
Which I have to watch Witch Hunt yet because I didn't realize that was a sequel to the Cast a Deadly Spell. Which
it's less silly, but it goes more for the noir atmosphere, I feel.
Sure, and I think Cast a Deadly Spell, if it came out now, it definitely would be more of a pilot for a show. You could see HBO with the way HBO is now with having more shows than movies, kind of like MTV. but yeah, I could see this set up because I wanted to see more about these characters, you know, this world that they put in. Julianne Moore, I thought was really good in it, you know, as the femme fatale, but yeah, you could definitely see more of these characters cropping up. I mean, the Charles Hallahan, Detective Morris, H.P. Lovecraft's old boss. I liked him, but you could see him being a recurring character. The landlord, Hippolyte, you could see her coming back as well. I mean, there was a lot of things in here where you're just like, oh, you know what? This probably would have made a cool miniseries almost.
Yeah, one, I like Charles Hallahan as an actor. He's been on lots of stuff. He was the captain on the old TV series Hunter. And he's been in tons of stuff, man. I mean, it's usually, you know, he's a character actor. So I mean, he plays cops a lot.
Yeah.
But although I think he's dead. Oh yeah. Wow, he died young.
Yeah.
He died at 54.
Yeah, unfortunately, he did pass away, but again, going back to the cast, as I mentioned in the beginning, it just surprised me who was all in it for a basic HBO film, you know, which is basically a direct-to-cable movie. Yet you have names in here who are all experienced actors. It's not like they gathered a large group of inexperienced folks, but HBO had been around, what, by now 10 years in 91?
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe they, you know, there is a little more appeal there with it.
Exploring in new directions aside from the Red Shoe Diaries.
Yeah, so David Duchovny and his Red Shoe Diaries.
Yeah, but I mean, the name, so I mean, Julianne Moore hadn't really done a lot up
by
till
that
this.
Point.
I mean, her big thing was... What was she on? What soap was she on? I think she was on As the World Turns.
Yes, As the World Turns. That's,
yeah. Yep. I mean, that was her biggest thing. I mean, she had done like one or two other things. I think she really hadn't. I don't think she had done like an actual movie. She'd done some TV stuff, and that's about it, wasn't it?
Yeah, she did. She was on BL Striker. She was in a TV movie called Money, Power, and Murder. And she was in a segment on the Tales from the Dark Side movie from 1990. But that was about it as far as feature films. So, yeah, she hadn't really been, I don't think, forefront for a film or lead actress, if you will, for a film. This was kind of her first role. And she would go on after this to go to do The Hand That Rocks the Cradle.
Yeah, she did a lot after. She did a lot right away after this. The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, Gun and Betty Lou's Handbag, Benny and June, The Fugitive, 9 Months, Assassins. Yeah, that all is boom, boom, boom. The Fugitive.
Yeah, The Shortcuts. She did a huge amount right after this. So this kind of was her launching point, maybe, for some of that. Got her noticed a little more because this did win an Emmy, as I may have mentioned before, which is kind of surprising, actually. I think, Dawn, didn't you mention it when we were watching it, how you were kind of surprised?
Actually, I'm not surprised. It's pretty good for a TV movie. I wasn't surprised that it won an Emmy.
Well, it's very original for a TV movie.
Yes.
It is a risk for what they were doing, trying to sell magic, because Magic still is kind of considered a bit cheesy, even with films like The Illusionist. Harry Potter. they came out in the same year, I think it was just about. Magic is always kind of a hit or miss, I think, with audiences. But this one, for a TV audience to sell this in a noir style, I thought, yeah, it was really original. And I think it's one of the things that appealed to me, because I always like amalgamation stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why a lot of people give it flack, but I don't really care, because visually I thought it was interesting, and that is Sucker Punch. I mean, when you've got a dragon going after a World War II bomber? I mean, mm-hmm. Come on! How cool is that? You know, so here we've got an entire world like that, where we've got gremlins and magic and noir and the gumshoe feel, and I think that's what appeals to me the most with this film is that originality and that fantasy that they built into this, especially in 91, because in 91 I was young, maybe 16, and I loved this film when I first saw it. I remember because they got a lot of play on HBO, though, too. It was on there quite a bit. But I think that's what appealed to me was, one, the noir angle, and two, just the fact that you have this amalgamation of 40s noir and magic worked in. Don, what about you? What do you think is the strongest appeal to you for this film?
That's hard to say. I like that it... Like Glenn said, I'm a fan of the urban fantasy, and watching it, it really made me think of, or try to think of, what was going on in urban fantasy at that point. Because I don't think it, and I wish I was quicker at looking at this stuff, but I don't think there was a whole lot. I don't think that urban fantasy was a really big, or maybe just starting to get its footing back in the early 90s. I think it's a couple years later that books like Anita Blake, Vampire Hunter, and then almost 10 years later that The Dresden Files came out. Sure. And that genre really took off.
Yeah, it didn't. This seemed to be early for your urban fantasy, at least for films and for TV as well.
Went the long way around. What I liked about it was that what I liked most about it, and the strongest point, was that mix that just kind of said, "Yep, this is what we are. This is mm-hmm. what we're doing."
Yeah, it did not shy away from it at all, or try to downplay it, I don't think, at all. Glenn, how about you? Is there one thing that stands out for you that kind of what appeals to you the most with this film?
I like the mixing of, again, as Don said, the mixing of modern times with fantasy, or just real life, you know, with fantasy. Right. There's a book I read, it was called Fairy Tale by Raymond Feist, and what year did that come on? 1988, and it's actually, it involves a family who moves to like a small town in, I'm trying to remember now, it was they read it like Kentucky or something, and there's like fairies in the woods, mm-hmm. and it's actually a darker fairy tale, and I've since I read that, I've had this thing with urban fantasy, and I also just like that it fits with the whole thing of Hollywood being, you know, I mean, it's a magical place out there. And, you know, how is everyone so good looking? Fucking magic, man. I mean, people aren't born looking like that. So I just think it fits so well, you know, with the setting as well. And noir, I mean, I like that. There's actually some really good kind of fantasy noir books, I believe, by Glenn Cook. And what is it called? I don't remember now. Oh, Garrett P.I. And it's all fantasies. He's a, you know, basically a hard-nosed kind of film noirish detective, but it's, you know, it's fantasy stuff. So it's probably one of my favorite genres. I mean, I liked my epic horror, but I'm also at the point now I'm like, I don't want to read 15 books in the series. Unless it's written by a friend of mine.
Yes.
So,
which 15 books, yeah. probably will take a very long time to happen from said friend, but I do agree that amalgamation is great. Urban fantasy, it's always great seeing someone expand or do something just a bit different with something that we've seen so much of, you know, noir films or magic films, and here it combines the two in a very interesting way. And you made a good point, Glenn. I didn't think about it till you mentioned it, that, yeah, out of all the towns in all the world, Hollywood would probably be one of the first ones to fully adopt magic by everybody.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it, not only is it a magical place, but they deal in fantasy. So, you know, the fact that you have this fantasy as reality makes sense that, yeah.
Well, and I mean, they have it now. It's called Photoshop and CGI and all that stuff. So, I mean, in a time when you didn't have that stuff, my God, can you imagine, you know, what you could do with film if you had magic?
Yeah. Right? Which would have been interesting to explore. And there you go. So, instead of a movie about a film being made in the world of Cast a Deadly Spell in 1948, that'd be...
Yeah. I mean, a movie now, you wouldn't have... Credits would be like half a minute long. It'd be like, special effects, Bob. That's it.
Yep.
Or, you know, or Hippolyte Kropotkin.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah, it definitely is a magical place. And yeah, seeing what they would be able to do with magic, sure, you could have only just one guy who we've got a warlock who does all our special effects for us. He just, you know, he's great. He's got this book, he does this thing, makes our actresses look 20 years younger. It's great. But it's interesting with this digital rip of this film, though. I like that, because Don, you mentioned it earlier how there was no Photoshop. You got to see a lot more imperfections, not just in people's like makeup and costumes, but in the practical effects and everything. And I think it gives it a little more charm, don't you think? Versus you know, something that's completely polished and crisp and soft edges.
Absolutely. It was so refreshing to look at Julianne Moore and say, hey, look, real freckles, not ones that are photoshopped out and then reapplied to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
She's a real human person here with imperfections. I love it. I don't feel there's no body shaming going on, because that's a real human, not airbrushed to have a hiney lift and a boob lift and these little lines smoothed out and maybe that curve straightened a little bit, you know. Yeah. Wrinkles and eye makeup blotches and frizzies in the hair. I loved it. I'm getting a little crazy here, but still, you get my point. It was a real human person that didn't make you feel bad about yourself for not being perfect.
Well, and that's the thing, is they all felt like real people. I mean, they were all, you know, played up a little bit, you know, but still, they all did feel like just real people in a world of magic.
Yep.
I think that helped. And I also think it helped with a little bit of the grittiness you want from your noir story. You don't want everything polished and perfect, whether it's your special effects or how your people look or how your sets look. Yeah, you kind of want that gritty look. You don't need the full polished CGI overhaul for your people. And yeah, I think it helps sell your characters better as realistic folks as well. So I'm going to leave it to you guys. Just ask you really quick, Glenn, is there anything about this film that we haven't already talked about that maybe you wanted to touch on, or something that stood out for you wanted to talk about at all?
I don't think so.
Okay.
See the sequel.
See the sequel.
Yeah.
I will definitely have to check that out. And Dawn, how about you? Anything that you wanted to mention or talk about on the show that we maybe not touched on? Like just, the end monster?
Oh, God. Okay, I'll get to that one. But just that it's interesting that in this, it's kind of fitting that the noir was paired up with the Lovecraft genre.
Mm-hmm.
In that, in a lot of Lovecraft stories, he really focused on the decadence of the modern world, of the modern West. And Lovecraft really was kind of anti-modern. Mm-hmm. And the whole concept that magic was the new decadence kind of worked with the Lovecraft bits that were tossed in, whether it was intentional or not, it mm-hmm. still kind of works. And that being said, all Lovecraftian horrors are sea-based, not desert-based.
So who was it, the Asgoth? I'm not familiar with the name,
goodness.
But the gatekeeper.
Which one? I forget. Yog-Sothoth, you don't want to summon Azathoth because he just devours the world.
Oh, okay.
It was Yog-Sothoth.
Okay.
and in the middle of the desert, an ocean being, ocean-dwelling being, that kind of went, well, why'd you go to the desert when you had a nice, convenient ocean? But hey.
Maybe because they couldn't quite do it. What do you think of the design of that creature, though, even though he was desert-based?
Oh, I didn't mind the design. Mm-hmm. All the creatures are based in madness, so yeah, as long as it looks insane, that's fine.
Well, could they have done it in the desert because they figured everybody was expecting the ocean, maybe, and so they were trying to go against
I don't think they were expecting many people to know who H.P. Lovecraft was.
Sure.
Exactly.
So figure they
could. Because, I mean, nowadays there's tons of movies based on his works. There are more board games you can shake a stick at, and a lot of people still have no idea. And I'm talking to people who come to my store who are game players who don't know anything about Cthulhu or H.P. Lovecraft.
Yep, and I'll fully agree. I don't know much at all about Lovecraft except what I learned from all my great friends who actually read words instead of me who just likes the moving picture.
Words are fun.
I've been told words are a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm trying to read Cabal right now, so I know I'm reading a book. Oh my god! Getting back to Cast a Deadly Spell, it is an interesting movie. I think it's a unique film, especially for the time that it came out. And yeah, if you're an H.P. Lovecraft fan and you haven't checked it out yet, you should. If nothing else, just for the fun of it. Even if you don't exactly care for Fred Ward, I think you'll really enjoy the world they built on this film. And especially for 91, I think it was an ambitious and an interesting approach they took to a film, and it paid off because it got them a few awards and nominations and such. So I think we're going to wrap it up tonight. I hope you enjoyed this discussion on Cast a Deadly Spell. Like I said, it's on what? What, Don? Are you laughing?
Oh, nothing. I'm just looking forward to watching the sequel. I haven't seen it yet.
Ah, yeah, and I haven't either. I have not either, so I'm looking forward to seeing it as well. But this is on Amazon Prime, so if you're an Amazon Prime member, it's free even for you to check it out. So, you know, and it's not even that long either, and I think you'll enjoy it if you're a fan of Fred Ward or Julianne Moore or the noir genre. You may look it for something different. Cast a Deadly Spell is definitely that. And so tonight we'll just wrap things up here, and I'll have Dawn and Glenn here tell us where they can find, where you can find their stuff at when they're not here. Dawn, go ahead.
You can find me at intheaudience.net.
Fantastic. And Glenn?
You can find me on Facebook with Guy in a Bunker Productions, on YouTube with Guy in a Bunker Productions, or just follow me on Twitter at Guy in a Bunker.
Fantastic. And head to specialmarkproductions.com for all your Movie Man needs. We've got final cuts there. We've got the spoiler room episodes there. A few other things. We're coming up on a number of milestones of things that I didn't think we'd ever reach. In a little over a month, we're going to be doing a month and a half. We'll have our 100th spoiler room episode. Not sure what we're doing there. We've got a 10th anniversary on YouTube for Special Mark Productions. And I'm planning a whole bunch of different things. So keep it here. Tell your friends. Have your friends tell their friends about the spoiler room where our conversation is fresh. But we do spoil the movies. Say goodnight, folks.
Goodnight, folks.